Hello and welcome to Zing Talk, where Ben Zinga brings you the biggest names and brightest minds from Silicon Valley to New York City. Today our guest is Whitney Tilson, the co-founder and chairman of the Value Investing Congress, a CNBC contributor and a widely followed investor and money manager. How are you doing today, Whitney?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you on. Could you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and what brought you into finance and investing?
Well, as the child of one of the first couples to meet and marry in the Peace Corps, it was not necessarily preordained that I would end up as a hedge fund manager. My parents certainly didn't instill it in me. They're both teachers. But I ended up developing an interest in business in college and then went to Harvard Business School. And really, it was only after business school that I really started to develop an interest in investing. I always thought that I would be an entrepreneur and build a business and be a line manager, et cetera. But what started sort of as a hobby, just sort of managing a little bit of my own money, I discovered Warren Buffett and Peter Lynch and started reading the literature just so I could do something sensible with what at that time was, $5,000 or $10,000. The first time in my life I ever had any savings, came after I graduated from business school and finally paid off my undergraduate and business school debt. So, the timing was pretty good. The mid to late 1990s, every stock I picked seemed to go up. So with the benefit of hindsight, I'll confess to being a bit of a late 90s bull market genius. And I thought, hey, this is great. It's my passion. I love doing it, and I'm having success doing it, so why not see if I can make a business out of it? So on January 1st of 99, I hung out my shingle as the world's smallest and, with the benefit of hindsight, least experienced hedge fund manager. And I had three investors, a little bit of my own money, some money I was managing for my parents, and my in-laws took pity on me and threw a little bit of money in as well. So I started with $1 million, and, for 12 years, I've fortunately learned very, very, very rapidly and put one foot in front of the other every day. And if you do that for 12 years, you can get a long ways. So, here I am 12 years later teaching other people investing, I guess.
Now, it's interesting that you mentioned that you came from a business school and that you were going to go into entrepreneurship. John Burbank, the hedge fund manager at Passport Capital, he was a fellow guest on Zing Talk, and he said the same thing. Did you have any businesses prior to starting your own fund? Did you ever try your hand in entrepreneurship?
In many ways in the nonprofit world. Coming out of college, I was one of the first people to join Wendy Kopp starting Teach for America. Then I did a couple years at Boston Consulting Group, and then in business school, I started a research project with one of Harvard Business School's most famous professors, Michael Porter, guru of competitiveness and strategy. And it was a project focused on the competitiveness of inner cities. It was after the LA riots and was focused on how do we create jobs and build businesses in places like Harlem and the South Bronx and South Central LA and South Side of Chicago and that kind of thing. So I actually, for 5 years after business school, helped build that nonprofit organization with Professor Porter and learned a lot about, because it was very business-focused, I spent a lot of time out there with, grubby little manufacturing and restaurant businesses and so forth, and learned a lot about competitiveness and strategy from Michael Porter. So it wasn't quite as crazy a career shift as it may sound to shift from running that nonprofit organization to running a hedge fund. But it was still quite a leap.
It definitely sounds like a very interesting transition. Now, as an investor, you've made a name for yourself for taking a value approach to investing. Could you briefly outline your strategy and what you look for when picking your investments?
Well, it really is as simple as buy cheap stocks and in our case, in the hedge fund, short overvalued stocks. But what is sort of simple in concept is very difficult in practice. We apply the timeless principles of value investing that are rooted in two terms. One is intrinsic value and the other is margin of safety. So what my partner and I, Glenn Tung is the other T in T2 Partners, Whitney Tilson and Glenn Tung, T2 Partners is the name of the business. Glenn, I started the business 12 years ago and ran it by myself for the first 5 years, and then Glenn joined me 6 years ago. Just a little bit of a sidebar. If I say I versus we, I'm not referring to the royal we. There are two of us who now manage the business. But what we try to do is calculate the intrinsic value of lots and lots and lots of businesses out there, and then in each case, we try and compare that to the market value, the implied value of the entire business as reflected in the stock price. And we're looking for the proverbial 50-cent dollars. We're looking for companies that we can buy a small ownership stake in, and that's how we view buying a company's stock, is we're owners of that business. And we think about it in this as if we were going to own the entire business at that price. And so we want to buy it at, we calculate the intrinsic value. That's concept number one. And then concept number two is we don't want to buy something that's valued at $900 million if we think it's worth $1 billion. We want a big margin of safety. And so the concept, because the intrinsic value of anything is a function of what happens to the business in the future, and the future is always uncertain, certainly as we've learned over the past 10 years. So just as you don't want to build a bridge that a one-ton truck is going to go over that is built for a 1.1-ton truck. You want to build in a huge margin of safety when building a bridge. We want to build a huge margin of safety when we're investing. So I can find 90-cent dollars, things that I think are 10% undervalued, all day long. But that's not a big enough margin of safety. The key to successful investing, once you have the ability to calculate intrinsic value, not for all businesses, but for at least some businesses, the key then is to be patient and disciplined enough to wait for situations where the odds aren't slightly in your favor, but where they're massively in your favor.
What brought you to this strategy? Did you ever try your hand in other shorter-term swing styles of trading?
Very early on, I bought a couple little stocks based on some stock tip from some friend of a friend or something, and fortunately lost my money. And I very quickly realized that was stupid. But I did have enough experience with it to understand how easy it is, even for a smart person, to be drawn into very foolish behavior as an investor. And that's actually one of the reasons why when I teach investing, I always try and teach the behavioral finance element of it. In other words, basically, behavioral finance is the study of how human beings are irrational when it comes to money. And the bottom line is the summary of that whole area of study is that human beings are hardwired to be massively irrational and do things that are contrary to their self-interest. And it takes study and discipline to overcome those natural human urges to, buy high and sell low, and to not save, and to chase the herd and so forth, and to look to the market for signals as opposed to, looking to your own analysis for signals. So that's an important piece of it as well. But very quickly, after losing some money doing foolish things, I discovered Warren Buffett, and it just made so much sense. I mean, I'm sort of, I grew up in a coupon clipping household, and I wore secondhand clothes in my childhood, and we always went to inexpensive restaurants, and we always literally for the first 40 years of my life, neither I nor my family had a new car, right? We always drove used cars. My parents were teachers; they were cheapskates, and that's good. And so when I discovered the cheapskates way of investing, which is I don't want to pay a dollar for a dollar. I want to pay 50 cents and get a dollar's worth of value. That's what I do when I go to the store. That's what I do when I buy a used car. Why wouldn't I do that in the investing world? So once I discovered value investing, it just clicked.
So what do you say to people that say buy and hold is dead? I mean, you've heard that, I'm sure, many, many times over the past few years, to say that the only way to make money in this market right now is to day trade or to try and trade on those market swings. What do you say to those critics?
Well, I hope that everybody listens to them, because it's people who believe that create opportunity for me. So as a self-interested investor, I hope as many people as possible turn into day traders and listen to Mad Money. As someone who would advise, as someone who cares about investors as a whole and so forth, I'd say it's complete nonsense. The answer is I'm not pounding the table and saying you should buy things and then hold them for 10 years. The answer is it depends. I can assure you that buying something today with the aim of selling it later today or tomorrow is a recipe for disaster. I know that for sure. And there are numerous academic studies that prove the point that rapid-fire trading is a sucker's bet for all but the most powerful supercomputers. I will acknowledge that there are some people like Jim Simons at Renaissance Technologies, for example, you know, has put up an incredible track record by being a Nobel Prize-winning mathematician and building computers that take advantage of small market anomalies. But for the average person, you are the sucker at the poker table, and trying to do rapid trading is madness. However, getting back to the behavioral finance piece, it's exciting. It's cheaper than going to Vegas. Like, you don't have to buy an airline ticket to go to Vegas to gamble. And it creates, human beings are naturally drawn toward things that create adrenaline, that are exciting, that you get lots of immediate feedback on, and where there's an element of gambling, and the possibility of getting rich quick. Nobody wants to get rich slowly. It's much more fun to get rich quick, right? So, but that is a recipe. Attempting to get rich quick is a sure route to the poorhouse. So, the alternative, though, is not to buy a stock and hold it for 10 years. The alternative is to buy, let's just say, Berkshire Hathaway today, which is one of our larger positions, and just the kind of safe stock that an average person, if they're saving for their retirement in 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years, that's the kind of stock that we think today is both safe and moderately cheap. I'm not saying buy Berkshire Hathaway and hold it forever. I'm saying buy Berkshire Hathaway with some idea of what it's worth. Today we think the stock is around $120,000. Let's use the B shares for simplicity. The B shares are at $83, and we think they're worth $100. So it's 17% undervalued, but we think the intrinsic value of Berkshire Hathaway is growing high single digits per year, let's say 8 or 10% a year. So if you hold that for 5 years, you should make 8 or 10% per year as the intrinsic value grows, and someday the gap between the current stock price and intrinsic value will close, and at that point, when it's no longer undervalued, you should probably sell it. And in reality, while we consider ourselves long-term oriented investors, over the past couple of years, stocks have swung so violently that sometimes we buy a stock at $10, thinking it's worth $20, and thinking that we might own it for many years, and 3 months later, the stock's at $20. Well, at that point, we sell. Now, someone might say, well, you're not a buy-and-hold investor, and I say, I don't claim to be. I claim to be an investor who buys things when they're deeply undervalued, and I sell things when they're fully valued.
All right, Whitney, could you give us, two favorite value stocks out there in today's market?
Well, look, I just mentioned Berkshire Hathaway, and Berkshire Hathaway, I mean,
right.
You might say, wait a sec, you just said it's only 17% undervalued. That doesn't sound like much of a margin of safety, and I will acknowledge that at today's price, Berkshire Hathaway is probably the least cheap stock in our portfolio, but it is also the safest stock in our portfolio, and in everything we own, there's a balance between safety and upside potential. Right, and first and foremost, we're interested in safety. Only then are we interested in what our upside is. So, so let me give you examples, a couple examples of safe stocks that we think are significantly more undervalued. One of our largest positions today is Microsoft. Like Berkshire Hathaway, it has one of the world's strongest balance sheets. It has it's a technology company, so it's inherently less safe than a much more stable collection of businesses like Berkshire Hathaway, but it's much, much cheaper, we think. We think Microsoft today, Microsoft is trading, if you net out about $4 a share of cash, the stock net of its cash is around $20, and they reported $2.10 a share in earnings last quarter over the previous 12 months. So it's trading about 9.5 times trailing earnings. And what's interesting is the disconnect between the conventional wisdom on Microsoft, which is that it's a dinosaur and a dying business, and the facts about Microsoft, which is last quarter they grew their earnings 22% year over year and earnings per share 50% year over year. I wish I owned more dying businesses growing their earnings 50% year over year. So we're delighted to take advantage of the disconnect that we perceive between the conventional wisdom and the facts about Microsoft. And the facts as we see them are that the company is in the midst of major new product launches in Windows, in Office, and in server software, the three areas that generate all of Microsoft's profits. Analysts are projecting 13% earnings per share growth over the next 12 months, which is actually pretty healthy growth for a big business. But we actually think earnings per share growth will be in the 20 to 25% range, and that the combination of that earnings growth plus some multiple expansion, less than 10 times earnings for a company the caliber of Microsoft is way too low, a multiple. So we think there's a reasonable chance that earnings are up 20% or 25% and that it trades at 12 times earnings at some point in the next year or two. And at that point, it'll probably be fully valued, and we'll make somewhere between 25 and 50% gain, and critically, without taking very much risk. Microsoft, we think, is very, very safe, both from a balance sheet perspective and from an earnings growth perspective, at least over the next year. But to be clear, this is not a 5- or 10-year bet. The technology companies, the world changes quickly enough that, you know, you have to inherently have a somewhat shorter time horizon on them.
Right. I also want to talk to you a little bit about the Value Investing Congress, which you co-founded. Can you tell our listeners what sparked the idea and how you got it all going?
Yes. Well, the way I learned to be a value investor was at the feet of the masters. Investing is an experience-based business. If you want to be good at it, you need to get experience. And there are only two ways to get experience. You can go out and do it yourself and make a lot of mistakes and get a lot of scars on your back, and I have a lot of them. Or you can learn from somebody else, ideally someone more experienced who will share with you the benefit of their experience without you having to endure the pain. Right? So if you think about how does someone get to be a great surgeon or a great fighter pilot, it's you go to school and you learn some basic skills, but then when you get out of medical school, do they immediately throw you into the surgery room and have you do brain surgery? Of course not. You start off as an apprentice to a more senior surgeon, and you learn skills over time, and you observe the master. So how do you do this in the investment world if you want to be a good investor? Because it's the exact same process. And the answer for me was I wasn't lucky enough to get a job working for Seth Klarman or Warren Buffett or Julian Robertson, for example. So I had to get my experience in a different way. So one way is I just went out and started investing and got a lot of scars on my back and lost some money doing it. But fortunately, I'm a fast learner, and I sort of had the right general approach. But the second way I learned is if I didn't have the opportunity to work for some of these people, I could at least learn from them in other ways. So, for example, I read every one of Warren Buffett's annual letters. I went to all of his annual meetings. Same thing with Charlie Munger and the Wesco annual meeting. Whenever Seth Klarman or a well-known investor was coming to speak at a class at Columbia Business School, I'd go sneak into the class and sit in the back of the room and learn from them. Joel Greenblatt, I owe a big debt of gratitude to. He not only wrote a great book early on called You Can Be a Stock Market Genius, but he taught a course at Columbia Business School, and he allowed me to sit in the back of the class in spring semester of 2000. Back when the internet bubble was in full craziness, he was teaching a class on value investing. So the idea before the Value Investing Congress is what would be the perfect conference for me? And the answer is we would invite the world's greatest investors to come, and we wouldn't put them on a panel which dumbs people down. We'd instead give them the stage for 40 minutes and ask them to teach and then to share some of their current favorite stock ideas. So teach our audience to fish and then throw them a few fish is the theory behind it. And since we started it, it's been a hit. We've been fortunate enough to get some of the world's greatest investors to come speak, and we've got a lineup next week that I think is our best ever.
And like you said, it's just been wildly successful since it began. I mean, some of these major speakers you alluded to, John Burbank, Phil Ackman, David Einhorn. Yeah. What do you think the impact of the Value Investing Congress has been on the broader financial landscape? Has it changed the conversation at all?
That's hard to gauge. We have certainly had market-moving stock picks from some of our more noteworthy investors. You know, Bill Ackman has talked about certain stocks that have moved. But in terms of broader market impact, I mean, it's hard for me to see any evidence that value investing, which is the core of what we preach at the Value Investing Congress, that value investing is becoming more popular. In fact, I think there's a lot of frustration out there that everything seems to be correlating, and particularly in the past couple of years, your bottoms-up stock picking was much less important than getting the macro right. If you correctly foresaw that the world was going to hell in a bucket in early 2008 and positioned your portfolio accordingly, you did well. And then if you had some idea that stocks had gotten really, really cheap and too much negativity had been built into them in early 2009 and then switched around and positioned your portfolio accordingly, it almost didn't matter what stocks you owned. It would just mattered what your overall long and short exposure was. And so my view is that period was a once-in-a-generation type of event, and that sometimes it's true that over a 1 or 2 or 3 year period, it's the macro stuff that matters. But over time, over decades, and that's certainly how I view my investment horizon. I plan to be in this business for another 50 years. I'm 43 years old, and I plan to live a long time, and I love what I do, and so you know, that's my time horizon. I think that 80-plus percent of the time, being a very good company and industry analyst is what really matters, and the resulting stock picks that come from it. And only 20% of the time, albeit that's what's been the case in the past couple of years, but only 20% of the time does it really pay to be a good macro prognosticator.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Be sure to subscribe in iTunes. You can find a link to do that right off of the Benzinga homepage. The music that you're listening to is Beethoven Virus by Banya and is available on the Internet Archive. All Benzinga podcasts are released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.5 license, and all other rights are reserved.